Hello, everybody, and welcome to the space. I'm glad to see some of you joining us here already. This is Matt Broomfield, as I think most of you are aware. I can see that we have three of our panelists here already, which is great. So I'm sending invites to you, Adam, to speak now. I'm sending an invite also to my co-host, Robin Fleming from Media News. You're very welcome, Robin. Looking forward to hear from you in a moment. And I'm going to invite Calvin from the New Lines Institute. And I'm going to invite Megan, who is joining us here from the Kurdish Peace Institute. Megan, you're very welcome. Okay, excellent. So I'm glad to see some of you joining us here now in the chat. We're going to start off with a few words from my co-host, Robin, in just a moment. We're just going to give a couple of minutes for the rest of the room to fill up. Glad to see some familiar faces joining us here already. Vaik, you're very welcome. I'm inviting you to speak now. Excellent. And my co-host Robin has now joined us as a speaker as well. Yes, I will actually invite you to co-host Megan as you're there with the Kurdish Peace Org. There we go. You should be able to accept that now. Okay, so let's see. I think we can get started now with our introductions. So I'm joined here today with my co-host, Robin Fleming from Media News, a regular contributor to Media News, who I'm sure that some of you will be familiar with. I myself am Matt Broomfield. I'm a freelance journalist. I've been following the Kurdish issue for some time now. I'm co-founder of the Rojava Information Centre. And yeah, I'm very excited for this conversation we've got today with so many great speakers. We know have a lot to say about the subject we've got now. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to my co-host, Robin Fleming, who will introduce herself and say a few words by way of introduction, and then we're going to get right into a discussion with our wonderful panelists. So thank you very much, everybody. I'll hand you over to Robin now. Robin, you're welcome.
Thanks, Matt. Hello, everyone. It's great to see so many people start to join in. As Matt said, this is Media News contributor Robin Fleming, and we're really excited for today's panel, which we're sure will shed some new light on well-trodden ground. Today marks almost 40 years since the beginning of the armed conflict between the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, on one hand, and the Turkish Armed Forces on the other. This conflict has continued and evolved throughout the following decades, at various times taking on the characteristics of isolated attacks, guerrilla warfare, and a full-scale civil conflict at times between the two parties. At the same time, armed violence is just one aspect of a much broader conflict, a conflict that reaches into every field of life in modern Turkey over values, rights, and two very different visions for the future of the Turkish state. If the past four decades have taught us anything, is that this conflict cannot be resolved through security or anti-terrorism measures alone. Rather, there's an urgent need for a political settlement leading to enduring peace, stability, and prosperity in Turkey. Such a settlement currently seems a distant possibility. Conflict between the PKK and Turkey has waxed and waned ever since the first clashes in the 1980s. We're fortunate today to be joined by expert panelists who can share their expertise on how this conflict has developed, looking in particular at the PKK's evolving approach to the conflict. The collapsed peace talks between PKK and Turkey from 2013 to 2015, and whether recent developments like a unilateral ceasefire declared by the PKK following this year's deadly earthquakes can provide any hope for change. The situation is currently extremely polarized, with Turkey's cross-border military operations and drone attacks, which nominally target the PKK, not only killing hundreds of civilians in recent years, but also making a move back to dialogue seem extremely unlikely. But as previous rounds of peace talks show, the situation can evolve fast, and nothing is ever a done deal in Turkish politics. Today, we'll be inviting our panelists to share future perspectives, some more immediate and some more distant, on ways forward out of the conflict. Thank you. I'll hand you back to Matt.
Thank you, Robin, for those words of introduction. And yeah, we're really looking forward to hearing the perspectives from our speakers today. I'm glad to see some of our other contributors and other familiar faces in the chat today. Rogine, Sarah, Hanafi, and others who I'm sure I haven't mentioned, and all of you who've joined us. There will be a possibility a bit later on to submit your questions to the panel. So to do that, please do just listen along, and either you can simply raise your hand and I can get you to put a spoken question, or if you'd like, just tweet us your question at this account, so at One Media News, and we will make sure to pick up those questions and put them to the panel. But now let's get going and hear some contributions from our panel. So just to say very quickly, by way of introduction, today we're going to hear from Adem Uzun and Fahd Yazghari, who are both leading Kurdish political figures here in Europe, for their perspectives on what can be done to move this conversation forward. And also to give us the European perspective, we're going to hear from Martin Dolzer, formerly of Die Linke, and for the American perspective, we have Calvin and Megan from the New Lines Institute and the Kurdish Peace Institute, respectively. So that's our panel, and we're just going to let them each say a kind of introductory few words now. So first of all, I'd like to invite Fahd Yazghari is the HDP representative to the Council of Europe. And Fahd, could you just give us, to begin with, an overview of the current situation and the mood in Turkey, particularly following the recent elections? How is the situation right now in Turkey? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think the situation is even worse than before the elections. Before the elections, there was a hope of change, but unfortunately, with the opposition, which was divided and not challenging enough to Erdogan, Erdogan won again. So this made people, because there were really very big expectations. But unfortunately, these expectations failed, and now there's people have lost their hope of change, and because of very difficult economic situation, about the repression on opposition, on media, on everybody living in Turkey, and the military operations in Rojava, on Iraqi Kurdistan. And all the things like this made people more be hopeless of change, and so this makes the current situation even worse and worse. Of course, there are some efforts of the Kurdish movement, especially in Rojava, in South Kurdistan, in Turkey, at least to have some discussions about the elections, what happened in elections and why we got these results. And the autocritics, that we are in a process of autocritics, and this, of course, makes us to prepare for the future. Now there is a closure case against our party, which is going on. And this decision can be made anytime that Erdogan wants. Kobani trials are going on, which will make a lot of friends be out of politics. There will be a ban, political ban on a lot of our friends. And probably in 1 or 2 months, these trials will be ended and a decision will be given. There is a big repression on democratic opposition. For example, every day, every week, the attacks on Saturday Mothers in Istanbul, the repression on media and military attacks on everywhere. This shows that Erdogan will continue the politics of repression, and even he gives some message to turn back to the good relations with the European Union. Even in the NATO, he get a green light to Sweden and try to have bargaining on this issue to become closer to the European Union, to get some support to the European Union. But the practices in Turkey are getting worse and worse. And on the other hand, he wants to keep his relations with Russia and even some relations with the Syrian regime. At the moment, it seems that it is not so easy, but still he is expecting to have some relations with Syrian regime. The situation of opposition now is really very bad, especially when we look at the main opposition party in Turkey, CHP. It's really a disastrous situation because the secret agreements of Kılıçdaroğlu with the extreme right-wing parties and leaders made big problems within the party. On the other hand, there is a desire of change within the opposition party, but as we see, Kılıçdaroğlu wants to stay there and keep his position, and there is a big unrest there. And when we look at the relations between the other opposition parties, which we called the Table of Six, now there is no, there is not a Table Six settlement of the opposition anymore. And now the everybody are preparing for the local elections, which are in a few months, in March 2024. And at the moment, with this situation of opposition, despite of all economic disaster, Erdogan seems to be very happy with the situation of opposition, and he thinks and he prepares for the local elections to win again. But of course, this whole situation makes us as HDP and the other democratic forces in Turkey to do our autocritics that we had during these elections, why we lost the elections, and have our congresses and prepare for not only for elections, but for a general struggle for challenging the repression of Erdogan. This is the general situation that I can tell you.
Thank you very much, Faik, and it's very useful to hear that overview and, yeah, to know also about a bit about these discussions that are occurring within the HDP, the parliamentary party, which represents so many millions of people there in Turkey. And we'll hear some more from Faik shortly, but we do have several more panelists that we'd like to hear from as well. So right now, I'm just going to go right ahead and bring in Calvin from the New Lines Institute in America, who has been closely following the situation from a security perspective as well throughout the broader region around Kurdistan, I know, for some time. And so, Calvin, yeah, to hear kind of the other side of that, what's Erdogan's domestic strategy for the remainder of his term, especially concerning the Kurdish issue and the PKK? What can we expect to see from Erdogan following his re-election in the coming years?
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much. It's great to be here. And I would really second, I think, everything that Faik just said about how much the situation has deteriorated post-election. I think, you know, Erdogan was very clear in the run-up to the election that he viewed compromise on Kurdish issues, both domestically and abroad, as being out of the question. And I think it's fair to say that he's really followed through on that commitment, you know, both domestically and in Iraq and Syria. During the election, I think Kurdish issues emerged as a bit of a wedge issue between him and his challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. With Kılıçdaroğlu, you know, just to take one issue, he was saying that he would release the imprisoned, politically imprisoned leader of the HDP, Selahattin Demirtas. And Erdogan obviously responded by saying the opposite, that he would keep him imprisoned. And on top of that, you had, you know, supporters at one of his rallies chanting for Demirtas to be executed, which I think really highlights, you know, just how bad things have gotten, to have Erdogan hearing that and not, you know, responding to that or disavowing that. So definitely it's fair to say that I think he's staked out a very hardline position, both domestically and abroad, in terms of wanting to sort of repress the HDP, repress sort of Kurdish political autonomy and activity in Turkey. I think, you know, just to touch sort of briefly on how that's manifested as well abroad, you've also seen an expansion of sort of drone strikes across northern Syria. You've seen an expansion of clashes with the PKK and a collapse of the PKK's ceasefire, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more later on. But I think it's fair to say that what we're seeing right now is basically more of the same of what we saw under Erdogan previously, a fairly hardline stance, an unwillingness to compromise, and a belief that there was a military solution, I think, is how he sees this, correctly or incorrectly. So, yeah, thank you so much. And it's great to be here. And I'm looking forward to hearing from the other panelists as well on this.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that perspective very succinctly, Calvin. And yeah, thank you to both of our contributors already. And I will encourage the other panelists to please keep their contributions to just 5 minutes or so. But also, if you want to come back and comment on anything that any of the other panelists are saying, then please do so. But yeah, please try and keep your contributions, as our first two panelists have, so succinct and to the point. So yeah, thank you to Faik and thank you to Calvin. So that's a kind of overall picture of this slightly worsening picture from what was already quite a grim situation in Turkey prior to those elections and that somewhat unexpected result where Erdogan was able to quite comfortably retain power. But of course, the purpose of this panel is to think about what are the steps forward, what are the kind of positive steps that can be taken in Europe, in America, in Turkey itself, and within the Kurdish movement, indeed, to facilitate a move towards peace. And so with that in mind, I'd like to invite our next speaker. We're very happy to be joined today by Adem Uzun from the Executive Committee of the KNK, the Kurdish Umbrella Organization. You're very welcome, Adem. And perhaps you could share with us some thoughts about a particular important issue in Europe. How can efforts in Europe to delist the PKK as a terrorist organization contribute to the pursuit of peace and stability?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be joining this panel. First of all, I have to say we are now celebrating, or we are now approaching the 14 years of the war in Kurdistan, and an uprising against the occupation and uprising for the self-determination for the Kurdish people. And unfortunately, the war is still continuing. Coming back to your question, how can efforts in Europe to delist the PKK contribute to the peace and stability in Europe? I think we have to make clear something in the beginning. So the PKK has never threatened Europe or its people. It even defended Europe from ISIS by defeating ISIS in Iraq, in Syria. So, but on the other hand, Turkey's war has destabilized Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, creating millions of IDPs and refugees, strengthen authoritarianism across the Middle East, and even spread into Europe, where Turkey spies on and kills dissident and tries to restrict protest and political activity. So it is clear which side is the threat to Europe and which side is not. So the designation of the PKK was a political decision, not a legal one. Everybody knows that. It was first listed in Europe in 1993 when Turkey's war on Kurdish people was at its height, and Kurds who were forced to flee to Europe as political refugees has succeeded at that time in winning political support among the European citizens. So the European countries designated the PKK to destroy this public support and prevent Europeans from learning about the Turkish crimes against the Kurds. We have to see this ban and this listing in that way. So on the other hand, it justifies Turkey's rights violation and destabilizing actions. So it allows Turkey to claim that it cannot negotiate with the Kurdish movement because they are terrorists rather than parties and armed conflict. We have seen the approval by the Belgium court, cassation court, where they said the PKK is the PKK is a party in this armed conflict, is not a terrorist organization. But Turkey ignored it, and the European Union by itself has ignored it too. Remaining still in the list, it allows Turkey to demand that its allies unconditionally provide it with all possible military support. Foreign military support is the key reason that Turkey can continue to fight this endless war against the Kurdish people. It also allows Turkey to claim that its anti-democratic actions and reorientations towards other authoritarian powers are justified, because it can say that it needs to crack down on democracy and ally with autocrats to fight terrorism. It harms necessary precondition for peace too. It contributes to the persecution and demonization of all Kurds in Europe and in Turkey, of course, by smearing them as terrorists. Peace requires public opinion and public support and open dialogue and understanding. But criminalizing the one party, in that sense, the PKK, legitimizes anti-Kurdish racism and politics that came from it. So peace also requires interlocutors and political engagement between different groups and individuals. The listing criminalizes these people and groups. So I'm an example for when we had the Oslo peace talks, the shuttle diplomacy from 2006 to 2009, then continuing from 2009 to 2011, face-to-face meetings, we have suddenly seen all our members from these peace talks were being sanctioned, were being labeled again, and were being put in some dark list. And I was, after this collapse of this Oslo peace talks, I was arrested in Paris, fabricated a case against me not being a peace seeker, in contrary, being a weapon dealer. So just trying to blame all the member of the Kurdish side being a criminal or weapon dealer. That is a strategy which is shared by the European countries, unfortunately, with Turkey. So the listing threatens the freedoms of speech and assemblies that Kurds and Turkish dissidents in Europe and all Europeans of all backgrounds value. It gives a foreign dictator veto power over what sort of protest European citizens can hold, what speakers they can host at conferences, what books they can read. This is a threat to very basis and fundamental democratic rights too. So that delisting is not only harming peace, is not only harming the Kurds, is not only destabilizing the area, is also damaging and destroying the democratic understanding in those countries where the PKK is listed. I am now leaving in that for that question. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Adam, for your contributions there. And yeah, to say this personal experiences as well, and also a reminder that this diplomatic playing field that we're talking about here is far from level, and the terms can change very rapidly, very quickly. So thank you for sharing that. That's invaluable, and also to highlight that things can also change very quickly on the legal front as well. well, I say change very quickly, that change can happen and that gradually the conversation is perhaps shifting on some of these issues. Okay, we have two more panelists to hear from today. And so then we're going to hear a bit more from all of our speakers, and then we're going to open to any questions from the floor. So again, yeah, any of you who are following who would like to send us a question, please do just raise your hand, and we can try and bring you in for a spoken question, or just tweet your questions at us or send them in a direct message and we can put questions to some of these speakers. But now we're going to hear from our next two speakers. We have Martin Dolzer, formerly of a Die Linke representative in Germany. But just before we hear from Martin, let's go first to our co-host. This event is co-hosted today with the Kurdish Peace Institute in Washington, who do sterling work raising issues around the Kurdish question there in Washington. We're joined today by their director of research, Megan Badet. And Megan, so we've just spoken a little bit about some potential steps in Europe and elsewhere with the delist PKK campaign. Given this increasingly polarized situation, what steps can the United States be taking to push for dialogue?
Yeah, of course. First of all, thank you for having me, and thank you to all our listeners and my distinguished co-panelists. So in a paper that we did in May that I think both really revealed and also caused itself some shifts in the way that these issues are discussed in a U.S. context, Calvin, who's on this panel, and I came up with a sort of concept to describe this of consolidating a pro-peace policy. And what we mean by that is first understanding that, look, the United States, as much as it may want to do so, simply cannot obligate any side or party to this conflict to do anything that they don't wish to do. Washington doesn't have that power, and it can't be approaching this as though it does. But what Washington does have is a great deal of leverage and a great deal of involvement in many different political and military dynamics that are impacted by this conflict. Northeast Syria, the situation there being perhaps the most serious example, but only one of many. And so recognizing that that leverage and that interest exists, recognizing that historically this is a conflict that the United States has been very involved in, and that in that past involvement, when we look at how Washington's put its finger on the scale, regrettably, on balance, this has mostly been support for policies that have further entrenched and militarized the conflict and led to the conditions of continued fighting that we see today, where we're now talking, unfortunately, about an unresolved conflict that's gone on for 40 years, causing all sorts of very serious security and fundamental human rights problems throughout that time. So Washington's track record of using its leverage has arguably contributed to prolonging this conflict to the state that we see it in today. So being honest about that history is important. And then with that realistic knowledge of what can be done and what's been done in the past, assessing all the current U.S. policies, approaches, talking points, on any of these issues that have been identified that relate to this conflict, whether that's Syria, whether that's Iraq, whether that's talking about Europe and NATO accession, taking stock of when U.S. policy incentivizes different political and military actors involved to take steps to de-escalate, when U.S. policy might incentivize further military aggression, and then adjusting those policies that seem to incentivize or provide cover for aggression, and continuing to develop and strengthen those policies that might promote de-escalation. And we've seen examples of both of these kinds of policies this year. If you read the report, which is linked in, I believe, our thread that we posted promoting the panel, you can see some of the discussion of U.S. engagement in trying to call for ceasefires and getting to periods of military de-escalation. That's something positive. That's the U.S. using its leverage in a positive way. But unfortunately, at the same time, we have the Biden administration talking about selling F-16 fighter jets to Turkey, where, you know, look, I've been to northern Iraq and northern Syria. I've stood in little Kurdish villages destroyed by U.S. origin F-16s. These people have been displaced. You know, when they think of the influence of the U.S. in their region, the image that comes to mind is the destruction of their homes. that's not something that contributes to peace and finding a settlement to this conflict, that sort of military support without conditions on how these weapons are used and where they're used is something that incentivizes those Turkish decision makers that see, for example, the targeting of civilians, the targeting of U.S. partner forces in the fight against ISIS, and the displacement of large numbers of people as acceptable costs in a very militarized, security-only focused view of this conflict. So adjusting policies like that, adjusting, taking stock of some of these legal designations, removing any legal designations or listings that pose impediments to peace and make it difficult for dialogue to happen, looking critically at arms sales and military support, and simply stating in public statements, as I believe Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Dana Struhl said last year, that there is no military solution. That needs to be clear. All sides need to hear it. And there can't be, we can't, we shouldn't be seeing rhetoric that might incentivize one side to believe as though its actions are supported when it takes steps that escalate conflict and lead to more aggression. So those are just a few ideas, but overall, when you take a holistic picture of the situation, consolidating a pro-peace policy, even in this very difficult time where conflict is escalating, is something that's only going to pay off in the long term when there are further opportunities for dialogue. And that could be the push that's needed to create conditions to allow dialogue to happen itself.
Thank you so much, Megan. And yeah, for sure, it's an excellent paper that was produced by our co-host today in the Kurdish Peace Institute and by Calvin from the New Lines Institute. And everyone should certainly read that for a more in-depth look at some of those points. But now let's turn to our final panelist, Martin Dolzer. Martin has worked for a long time with Die Linke, a parliamentary party in Germany that has long taken an active and progressive position on the Kurdish issue, and also a regular contributor with some thoughtful and very useful contributions to Media News addressing some of these issues we're talking about today. So, yeah, Martin, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us. And perhaps you could share some thoughts with us about whether there are other legal routes for pushing for peace over Turkey's actions against the Kurds.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
That's fine. Of course, the occupation in Rojava, especially in Afrin, is illegal. It's a contravention to the international law. And the occupation is brought forward together with Islamist forces like Daesh or al-Nusra, what is in fact supporting and fostering terrorism by the Erdogan regime. And of course, the ethnic cleansing in Rojava's Afrin district is illegal, of course. And the extrajudicial killings and the illegal things they are doing there together with the Islamist forces, these are war crimes. And they are documented on the level of United Nations and national parliaments. And when we see the army's attack on PKK-held areas and the civil population in the Kurdish provinces in northern Iraq, which has been ongoing now since years, it's a contravention of international law as well. And it's said, for example, stated by the scientific service of the German Bundestag in a report in 2020, and it still holds true today, that there is no self-defense situation. And then on top, there had been a lot of war crimes like the use of intensive use of chemical weapons against the guerrilla and tunnels and the civil population in northern Iraq. And these are war crimes as well. So we might ask ourselves why the OPCW, the Organization for the Prevention of the Use of Chemical Weapons, don't intervene. It just intervenes if a state calls it to intervene. And the Kurdish people don't have no state. So something has to be changed in international law that populations which are confronted with chemical warfare, for example, could bring an international institution as well into work. So I think there can be legal ways, of course, to end the conflict, but therefore the strategies of the conflict parties have to change. The PKK and in Rojava, the PYD, they are the representatives of the Kurdish movement. They bring forward peaceful ideas all the time, like Abdullah Öcalan, brought forward a peace process, which had been negated by the Erdogan regime in 2013-14, and then the war escalated. So there is ideas how to bring forward legal processes, but the parties which are in, it's like the US, like the European states, like Turkey and Syria as a regional conflict parties, they have to change. The USA has a Greater Middle East project, which meant the destruction of Libya, Syria, Iran, and Iraq into smaller parts due to religious and feudalist borders, potential borders, and so on. And they brought forward this plan quite far. The European countries have some kind of neo-colonial strategies as well. And then there is the Turkey, which has the neo-Ottoman project, and Syria, which wants to be a state like it had been before. So there's different interests. So the neo-colonial interests have to be stopped. And there's Russia as another party in Syria, which wants to stabilize Syria. All this are part in what is going on. And if we want to overcome the illegal ways in this war, conducted in this war, like the war crimes by Turkey, the abuse of international law by Turkey, and the destructive neocolonial policies of some other states, then there must be a change in these countries and the policies of these countries. The human rights should stand in the middle of the policies and not the geostrategical and economical interests. So we have some contradiction in between what the Kurdish movement is standing for a self-determined development of the region in respect of all religious and all cultural and ethnic groups who live there, in respect of the state borders which are there on the one side. And we have some other forces like Turkey who wants to widen its border and doesn't mind to work with Islamist forces, therefore, due to a new Ottoman project. Or we have the US and the European Union states on the one side and Russia on the other side wanting to have more control in this region. So all colonial powers have to step back, and Turkey has to drop its Ottoman project if we want peace in that region, because peace only can come when every part, every party in a conflict is ready to respect the security interests and the human rights interests and all the interests of all the other parties. The Kurdish movement many times brought forward that it's ready to do that. Abdullah Öcalan did it, the PYD did it, the YPG did it, the PKK did it. Everyone was saying, we want peace, we want respect, we want to find a peaceful solution. But if we want that, there has to be changes as well in the respect of international law. In the moment, all the bigger powers, the greater powers in the world seem not to respect international law. That has to change. If we don't have a change in that, there will be no peaceful solution. And then one last aspect I want to mention, especially in Germany, for example, the PKK has to be banned from the terrorist list. The PKK is not a terrorist organization. It's a freedom movement. In Belgium, we have some kind of good decisions of courts due to that, that the PKK is combatants in a fight and not terrorists. We have to change that as well. But there is a lot of work to be done by the populations in Europe and the US as well to bring their governments to respect international law and human rights.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Martin, and we look forward to hearing some more from you and from all our panelists in just a moment. I can see we've had one or two great questions in already that we look forward to asking just possibly after the hour. But first, I'd like to hear from all of our panelists again. We've heard a lot about some of the significant issues and challenges that face any diplomatic or political or judicial move toward peace, or even towards dialogue and diplomacy. But there are some instances in recent history which or semi-recent history, which give us some cause for hope, some indications that things might be different and there is perhaps more space for dialogue, for ceasefire, and for some kind of move forward. So that's what we're going to look at in the second half of this panel. Firstly, I would like to invite again Faik from the People's Democratic Party, or HDP, to speak. And Faik, as we know, there were peace talks in place, as we've mentioned, for example, in 2013 to 2015, between the PKK and the Turkish governments. How were these peace talks achieved in 2013 to 15, and can they be repeated? Hi, Faik. Can you hear me?
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Yeah. No problem. Hello.
Hi. Hello? Hi. Did you hear my question?
Yes, I heard your question.
You're just welcome.
I forgot to open my microphone. Sorry.
No problem.
Kurdish movement has always tried to find a political solution to the Kurdish question through peace talks. First, Öcalan started. Ceasefire in 1993, a unilateral ceasefire, and many other ceasefires after, and the last one which failed, the Oslo talks, and always after this attempts of peaceful solutions, the ceasefires. As they failed, there were more harsh conflicts between the PKK and the Turkish army. And this time also, again, after the fail of Oslo talks, there were a lot of resistance from everywhere in the world by the Kurdish movement. Harsh fightings in Kurdistan, hunger strikes everywhere in Europe, in prisons, in Turkey, everywhere. And this made really the government, put the government in a very difficult situation. And the government had to ask help of Mr. Öcalan to find a solution to this, especially hunger strikes. And he made it possible to put an end to this hunger strikes. And this made Turkish state that Öcalan can be really a counterpart for finding some solutions. Of course, we know that Erdogan is not sincere in his all attempts, all peace talks or dialogue, etc. We know him very well. But sometimes he always thinks about his interests, about his power, how to stay on power. When he had some problems within the AKP and between the AKP and the Gulen movement, he needed some other ways, and that also made him to start dialogue with the PKK. Resistance of the Kurdish people, especially of Kurdish movement, made Erdogan and forced Erdogan to start a peace talks. We should know this. On 3rd of January 2013, the meeting of Ahmet Türk and Ayla Akat Ata, our friends from HDP with Mr. Öcalan, was the beginning of this process openly, that it made openly. Before there were some secret deals, dialogues and talks, but this made this process be done openly. And Öcalan started to give some message, especially his message in Nevruz celebrations on 2013, 2014 and 2015. Always he called for a peaceful solution. Always he called for a new era, that it is not the time of fighting, but it is the time to find solutions through democratic politics, etc., etc. And when we look at this message, but unfortunately, Erdogan always wanted to continue these talks, but without any guarantees. For example, Mr. Öcalan wanted some legal guarantees for the mediators, because our friends who were meeting Mr. Öcalan, going to the mountains, meeting the PKK, and coming to meet the government, etc., did not have any legal guarantees. And Mr. Öcalan wanted some other, the third parties, international observers within the talks, but Erdogan never did this and never accepted this. He wanted just to talk, and through talkings, through a dialogue, to find a way to defeat the Kurdish movement. But during this time, you know, there was there were attacks of ISIS on Kobani, and our parties called for people to resist in support of Kobani resistance, and the attacks of Turkish police on people, everybody knows this. So this made Turkish state to come to another decision. And there was a meeting of Security Council of Turkish state. And in this meeting, they decided to destroy the Kurdish movement. But it was kept secret. And they continued dialogue. But of course, we knew that Mr. Erdogan is not sincere. Mr. Öcalan also knew that he is not sincere. But we wanted to do our best in order to find a political solution. And during this process, of course, the Kobani resistance also became successful, and the people stopped, the fighters stopped the ISIS and then defeated it. In Turkey, the peace atmosphere made the HDP to be more powerful. Despite of all repression on our party, the attacks on our rallies of elections, we succeeded to get 13.2% of the votes and 80 members in the parliament. And Erdogan lost his majority to govern alone. This made him mad, of course, the resistance of Kobani, the success there, and the our success in elections 2015, 7 June 2015, made Erdogan to change his policies. And he decided that the peace talks or peaceful solution is not working for him, but worked for us, for the Kurds. We succeeded to liberate Kobani and pass the 10% threshold in Turkey and have 80 members in the parliament. So he did not accept the results of these elections and renewed the elections, you know, in November. And during this period, he attacked. He had a lot of attacks. We know that it was organized by the Turkish intelligence service. They call that it was the ISIS attacks, but we know very well that these attacks were all under the control of the Turkish intelligence service and decided by the Turkish state. And through these attacks, he succeeded to get the majority again in November elections. And but the talks and the solution process continued. But of course, it was very difficult to go on that way. At the end, in 2015, February, the end of February, there was an agreement in Dolmabahçe. We say Dolmabahçe agreement. And there were 10 points how to succeed the peace process and how to go forward in this process. And it was decided by Erdogan. And even our friends say that he decided who will sit down where, but a few days later, he said that I did not accept this agreement, and this is not my agreement. There was Kurdish question. We solved it, and there is no Kurdish question. And he started another process. Many people think that or know that the peace process ended when there was an attack on two policemen were killed in Ceylanpınar, but it is not true. First of all, when just after Dolmabahçe just after the success of HDP in elections, a spokesperson of AKP said that now you will make the films of the peace process because they lost, and that's for them losing the elections was the end of these talks, of this peaceful dialogue or solution. So in 2015, unfortunately, everything became worse and worse, and then came until now. You say, is it possible that it can be repeated? I don't think that it can be repeated. The same thing never can repeat it, because that process was not sincere and could not manage anything, could not manage to find a solution, a political solution, a peaceful solution to the Kurdish question. So, and on the other hand, of course, there is not any war in the history that goes on forever. There will be an end to this war. And we don't know whether it will be this government or the future governments, but there will be a new peaceful solution, peace talks, to find a solution to this question. But of course, this will not be in the same manner or same format. It will be more transparent. It will be more sincere. And there should be some guarantees and international observers also as a part of this process.
Absolutely.
Now I stop here.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Faik. And it's really invaluable to have this inside kind of observations and experience from political actors and your party in Turkey. You've played such a crucial role in this process. I think now we can bring in also Adem Uzun again, and as we know, also has first-hand experience of some of these negotiations. Adem, do you have something to add to what Faik said? Why did these talks fail? Can we hope to see something like this begin again in the future?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think Faik has tried to summarize the developments during this time period. Of course, Erdogan was opportunistic and pragmatistic and afraid of growing Kurdish political power. He wanted to use these peace negotiations to marginalize his opponents in Turkey and to empower himself within the Turkish system in military, judiciary, and legislature, and get political and economic support from the international community. We remember at that time he made a big propaganda that he's the peace man, that he is seeking to solve all the questions, and for that he needs the support of the European Union, of the US, on the West. So made that propaganda to gain their support and get domestic support from and get them and he. He waited to get domestic support from 20 million Kurds. He was successful in the first aim, taking over the state and marginalizing his opponents, but he couldn't succeed in getting the Kurds to vote for him. Kurds voted, as Faik said, for the HDP in record numbers and won 30.3 of the votes. This made Erdogan afraid, and so he ended the peace process because it was no longer to his advantage. He was also afraid of Kurdish aspirations in Syria and the defeat of Islamist there, which threatened his expansionist plans to promote Sunni Islamism and restore the Ottoman Empire. He needed the fight against the Kurds as a justification to occupy former Ottoman territories in Iraq, in Syria, and just after the end of the peace talks, we have seen he has started new occupation operations in both countries. So we, the Kurds, were, as we always have been, sincere about the peace and willing to sit down for a chance at gaining rights for our people and, of course, ending all these suffers. If we want to have a new peace negotiation or peace talks or a new process, of course, it needs new conditions. With all the old conditions, you cannot start. The new conditions have changed, the demands have changed, and of course the environment has changed. At that time, the participation from Öcalan has led to unprecedented success. For example, he was able to declare ceasefires that lasted nearly 2 years until Turkey broke it. So therefore it needs and again the voice of Mr. Abdullah Öcalan. Without his voice, without his involvement or without his agreement, I think a new peace talks or process cannot be a realistic one. On the other hand, it needs a third party too, and third party has to observe all the developments and political reforms in Turkey, and international pressure has international pressure is very important, and we know that international pressure on Turkey has prevented a third Turkish occupation in Syria. So countries know that, and the countries have to play their role in that. Knowing that Öcalan is the leading negotiator, countries serious about peace must pressure Turkey to follow its own laws, allow him to communicate with family and lawyers, and ultimately facilitate his freedom to participate in finding a political solution. I think when that is done or these conditions are prepared, a new peace process or peace talks can start immediately. And we know that Öcalan always said, if I have the chance to be involved again or to come to voice, we can solve that question within 1 week.
Absolutely. Thank you, Adam. And I hope, yeah, we maybe have time a little bit later on to speak a bit more about Öcalan's potential crucial role in this process. But now let's just take some final quick contributions from our panelists before we open up to the floor. We have a couple of questions already from listeners that I want to get to. But firstly, there's something that I would really like to speak about. I'm going to turn now to Calvin again from the New Lines Institute. So looking kind of in just this year, there was a recent ceasefire, which was declared unilaterally by the PKK, essentially in response to the earthquake which hit Syria and Turkey, with the idea, of course, being, as it was stated, to give time to rebuild the country and so on. What was the aim with this unilateral declaration of a ceasefire, and could such a step be repeated?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really important question, and I think both sides of that are important, both what caused the ceasefire to be declared in the first place and also whether or not it's possible for us to go back to that arrangement. As far as why it was declared, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, the sort of the proximate reason or the proximate cause was the earthquake itself and the desire to not be escalating the conflict or inflicting any harm on anybody while there was still sort of life-saving humanitarian operations underway. But at the same time, obviously, the ceasefire lasted quite a bit longer than can be explained for that reason alone. It lasted all the way through June. And I think that there's kind of two core reasons behind that. The first one, obviously, being the election cycle itself in Turkey and the PKK's desire to kind of signal to both sides, to both candidates in that election, that there was a willingness to de-escalate, to compromise, and to basically open up that door for dialogue during the election itself. And then I think that was kind of borne out by the fact that you essentially had the ceasefire last all the way through the election. And then obviously, once Erdogan was reelected, the ceasefire stayed in place for another few weeks until Erdogan basically resumed the policies that he had in place before in terms of drone strikes and artillery shelling against Kurdish-led groups in Iraq and Syria, which I think persuaded the PKK that it to sort of end the ceasefire as well. And that kind of played a decisive role in that decision-making process. I think the second issue, which is sometimes underemphasized, but also really important to understand, is just that Turkey's military capabilities, and in particular their drone strike capabilities, have really expanded a lot over the past 10 years. And the drone strike capabilities, coupled with the expansion of Turkish bases across northern Iraq, has really expanded Turkey's ability to put pressure on the PKK, which is both, I think, incentivized the PKK to de-escalate and to find new opportunities to de-escalate. But I think the unfortunate effect that it's had at the same time is that it's persuaded Erdogan that it's possible to pursue a military solution to the conflict, and that it's possible to just win outright without having to have any negotiation. And when I say that that's misguided, I think it's misguided partly because, as we've seen, these drone and artillery strikes kill civilians on a regular basis, partly because Turkey is targeting civilians when it comes to the Autonomous Administration, and partly because there are just misfires and strikes that hit civilians, like we saw in the artillery shelling on Dohuk last year, which killed 8 Iraqi civilians. And that obviously hardens resolves, and it creates a whole set of other issues that aren't even directly related to the Kurdish conflict itself when it comes to Iraqi foreign policy and Iraqi relations and Syrian relations with Turkey as well. But I think it's also misguided to think that there's a military solution. And we talk about this, Megan and I, in our report that we released in May, because the conflict with the PKK itself is downstream from a broader Turkish approach to Kurdish issues domestically and to Erdogan's own nervousness and anxiety about Kurdish political autonomy and social rights domestically in Turkey. And that there's not really a way to sort of solve that militarily, that has to be a process of essentially acknowledging the human rights and the political participation rights of Kurds domestically in Turkey. And so I think that is sort of the second aspect of the situation. And then I would just add one sort of third small important issue, which I think is also that there was quiet pressure behind the scenes by international actors and certainly by the United States to pressure the PKK to de-escalate. And I think that that also played a role in the decision-making calculus, both to announce the ceasefire and then also to extend it for as long as they did, which I think brings us back to the question of whether or not it's possible to replicate that. And I would say the answer is yes, definitely. But the problem is, or the challenge is, that there needs to be pressure not only on the PKK to incentivize them to negotiate, but also on Turkey and on Erdogan to change his calculus and to change his approach towards seeking a military solution, which I think, you know, when Megan and I outlined that concept of consolidating a pro-peace policy, part of that is about more explicitly linking U.S. military supplies to Turkey to progress on this issue set. And I think part of it is also seeing the PKK conflict as being downstream of this broader Turkish approach to Kurdish political issues domestically in Turkey, which means that the United States needs to be paying attention to repression and imprisonment of HDP leaders and of Kurdish leaders domestically in Turkey, and of seeing that as linked to sort of the PKK conflict as well, and incentivizing, or pressuring Turkey to make progress domestically on these issues as well. I think that would basically be necessary as a baseline to change the calculus in Ankara about whether or not, peace negotiations and a ceasefire is necessary. So yeah, I guess that's my two cents on this, and I'm excited to hear from the other panelists on it as well.
Absolutely, thank you so much, Calvin. That's a very thorough answer and very useful. And let's turn now to Megan from the Kurdish Peace Institute. To, I guess, sort of build on what Calvin's just said, we've spoken, a lot about the difficulties and how this negotiation has gone on. Are there other unilateral steps that the PKK can take themselves and ways they can change their approach to the conflict to demonstrate the will to reform or to move toward peace. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I think that when we ask that question, it's important to take a bit of a historical and political look at the context that we're already discussing these issues in. Because one thing that we bring up in the report, and that is common knowledge, I'm certain, to all of us here, but I found not to be common knowledge to people who aren't already experts on this issue, is that the conflict in Turkey right now is not one of setting up new borders. Because 20 years ago, in the early 2000s, after facing significant political and military setbacks, the PKK changed its political program and its sort of philosophical approach to the concept of self-determination. And you can read about this in their own documents and in the books that Öcalan has published from prison, where they began to argue that Kurdish self-determination could be sought within the existing borders of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria through the transformation of political and social relations within those countries, as opposed to through the founding of a new Kurdish nation state. And of course, that, when you look at it theoretically, gets into a lot of philosophical and political debates about what a nation state is and whether it's desirable to have one. But from a conflict resolution perspective, that was a very innovative and very pragmatic unilateral move, because conflicts where there's no actual fight over territory, but simply a fight over the form of political and social relations that exist within a given territory and even beyond that territory, are easier to resolve because nobody's talking about drawing new borders. And the ideas about self-determination and political and civil rights that are put forward there are something that are very much applicable to and easy to synchronize with prevailing existing international law on human rights and self-determination. So this is something that they've done before in response to both outside pressure and to their own internal sense of pragmatism and taking the initiative. You know, we've seen that during previous peace negotiations, it's been Kurdish groups, both on the armed side and the civilian side, that have put forward the detailed plans of what would a post-agreement Turkey look like. We've seen this in the democratic autonomy proposals from legal civilian pro-Kurdish parties about how they would implement within the existing borders of Turkey, essentially a plan for a very bottom-up system of democratization that wouldn't just allow Kurdish regions, but would allow any region of Turkey a greater deal of local control over governance versus central control, and elected control over governance and community organized control over governance versus control over how things are governed that's dictated from the center out and the top down. So they've done this before. I think now what needs to be done is, like they've done in the past, proposals for a solution that fit the conditions of the time. You know, Kurdish decision makers need to be communicating to not only relevant political actors in the region, in Turkey and elsewhere, but to international political actors as well. What is it that they want? What is it they will do to get there? And what are specific steps that they would take if other steps are taken? You know, I think a lot of times when we see these discussions about solving the conflict, a lot of people can say, oh, well, it should be resolved. But when you get into how to do that, you're seeing sort of that responsibility about what is the plan, what are the steps that can be taken, what's expected in return. That's not always there. And then when we look at what Calvin talked about in terms of the ceasefire earlier this year, how there were these credible reports of U.S. involvement and pressure there, that is an example of, in my assessment, what can happen when there are, you know, clear interactions with clear offers on the table as to what can be done and what different actors can do to work together to get these concessions and agreements and plans to a point of action. Obviously, that ceasefire didn't have the outcome that I think a lot of people wanted to. The conflict has certainly resumed and has been very heavy recently. But it shows that these discussions can be had. I think another thing that's going to have to happen too, and that's something that the Kurdish side and the Turkish side are going to need to prepare themselves for, is that if this is going to be resolved, it's going to be resolved with some form of third-party mediation. And I think reaching out to those third parties, offering them plans for what can be done, is something that not only should Kurdish groups be doing, but honestly, if Turkey, in the end of the day, if they want to in any way find a sustainable solution to what Calvin and the other speakers explained is not only this military conflict, but to this broader social problem, it's ultimately in their interest as well for there to be a third party offering them rewards for doing this and keeping negotiations together. So I think all sides of the conflict need to be presenting actionable, clearly delineated plans to the international community. And I think the international community needs to be ready to hear those plans and take action on them. So, you know, I think that it's time for adjustments in the strategic and political thinking that are realistic about the current political conditions. I think that when that's been done in the past, it's led to success. I mean, when we look at, you know, these ideas about self-determination and self-governance without a state, we can see, for example, in Northeast Syria, where they've taken a lot of inspiration from these concepts. Certainly, their system is not perfect, but when you compare it to what the Syrian opposition has done, and when you compare it to what the Syrian regime has done, they have, because they believe in ideas like this sort of multi-ethnic, locally based system, because they believe in freedom of religion and belief, because they believe in gender equality and giving a prominent role to women, they've been able to build stability. And because they have ideas worth fighting for and a concept of self-determination that's powerful, they've been able to maintain the ability to hold that project together. But at the same time, because they aren't fighting for the creation of a new nation state, they're able to attract multi-ethnic support or at least cooperation in the communities where they need that. And they're able to have their model be significant leverage towards real change for the future of Syria for everyone, for all Syrians in all areas. And that's something that's much more doable and much more beneficial in the long run than simply breaking off a new state. So we can see that these ideological and political innovations work and that they can be very, very well attuned to the context of the region that they're in when they're adopted and taken up by new groups. So that's the kind of thinking that's going to have to get us as people observing these conflicts, as decision makers in Washington, as decision makers in Turkey, as decision makers in Kurdish groups. Everyone needs to be thinking about the practical steps that can be taken and making offers of what those can be and where they can go. I encourage more analysts to continue to write and think about this. I think, you know, as somebody who's been writing about it and thinking about it for a long time, there's not a lot of material there. And I think that when we start to see more proposals that aren't simply continue to fight forever, which is what you hear, unfortunately, a lot from Turkish decision makers, or solve it with no plan as to how to solve it, which sometimes comes from, you know, well-intentioned people who want to see a solution from the Kurdish perspective but don't know how to get there. When we start seeing detailed proposals, that will be something that will be able to lead us to finding a real solution. And, you know, that's something that the Kurdish movement and groups inspired by it have done in the past. I think Turkey is capable of it too. I think countries that have interests in seeing stability and long-term security and peace and political functionality in this region have interests in it too. So, you know, that is a big task for everyone.
Thank you very much for those thoughts, Megan. We're going to turn in just a moment to take a couple of questions that we have submitted from the floor. So, yeah, one last time. If people do have questions, then please do either send us a direct message or give us a tweet at this event at One Media News, and we'll be able to put a couple of those questions before we finish up here. But firstly, let's just quickly turn for a kind of final comment from the panel as panel to Martin Dolzer. And just to finish on a bit of a sort of wider perspective, really, Martin, I wanted to ask you, we've been talking a lot about, you know, how can we move forward on this conflict? How can it be solved? But my question is, why should European states, why should the West be so concerned about this conflict? Why is it important to be thinking of solutions for this issue?
Yes, that's indeed a very interesting question, which I will answer on two levels. One is the imminent level, the level of decision takers in governments, the states, and the other level is the level of the majority. It is the level of the people themselves, of us. On the first level, on the level of the states, of the governments, the decision takers, I think there should be a very pragmatic analyze and practice of the reality in the moment. If we look at the reality, we are in a historic phase in which the redistribution of the global balance of power is taking place. The US hegemony is more and more in question. The BRICS states are getting stronger. And in this phase, Erdogan is trying to benefit of that process with a very aggressive neo-Ottoman project. We have been seeing that he forced Sweden to enlarge their so-called anti-terror legislation and so on to become a NATO member. We see the occupation of Afrin and the attacks on northern Iraq. We've seen his politics. And in this phase, the decision makers in Europe, to my mind, the governments, they can decide whether they want to work, for example, with democratic actors like the Kurdish movement, or whether they want to keep on working with aggressive actors like Erdogan, who wants to bring forward his new Ottoman project, who brings forward a very aggressive politics against all opposition in Turkey, with more than 30,000 political prisoners who vegetate in the prisons under very, very bad circumstances, and who's working with Islamist actors. And the European, the Western countries, they shouldn't continue to act together with Erdogan just to bring forward their colonial aims without forcing him to change his politics in belonging to the Kurdish question and in general. Because if they don't, it will lead into a dead-end street, because the West, the European Union, they are losing power and of their strengths. And if they don't change their politics, there will be more and more destruction, especially in a worldwide economical crisis. Some actors tend to do world war. In the Middle East, we have world war. The Kurdish population in Rojava is in a kind of war all the time. And so we have to see how we can go on in that. And then we have, for example, in the diaspora in Germany, in other European countries, there is a lot of people who are coming from Turkey and the Middle East, and they are living in kind of extraordinary societies. They are radicalizing very harsh in parts, not all. I don't want to make prejudice, but if you look in reality, there's a lot of mosques in Germany who are only under control of Erdogan and who bring forward its Ottoman and some Islamist ideas very fast. So if the politicians here, they are pragmatic, they would take that into account and might think of whether it's not better to work with a democratic movement than to destabilize the whole world through ignoring the developments which are going on worldwide. If we then think of the perspective of the people, it is very difficult to achieve peace in a region and global peace in a capitalist system, because capitalism is based on the violent implementation of one's own goals against other goals. And that, in the worst case, means that authoritarian formations, Islamist or fascist formations, take government or take states under their control, and there will be war. The First and Second World War were triggered by worldwide economic crisis. We are in another worldwide economic crisis. We have the war in Ukraine. We have war in Syria, in Yemen, in several African countries. And in this crisis, I think the people the people in the global south, those who are called the damned of this earth, the workers, those who are excluded from social justice, ethnical and religious groups like the Kurds, like the Yazidis, like everyone in African countries who is of an ethnic or religious minority, they have to manage to organize themselves and to connect international, to my mind, as well. And then they have to try to find a way which is very much due to international law, to human rights, to equality, to women equality, to the strengths of real democracy. And they have to bring forward that aim, even so if that means struggling in their own countries, what is necessary, because democracy is in a crisis in the moment in this modern capitalist world. And in the worst case, fascism and barbarism could emerge from this. If we look at the AfD in Germany, it's getting very strong. The Front National in France, it's getting very strong. Trump, Bolsonaro in Argentina, various right-wing forces who are getting strong in their societies, because we as the left, we as the humanist and the democratic people, we have to find solutions which bring us forward out of this crisis of democracy. And so we have to struggle for that, to my mind, in our own country, and we have to overcome our own deformation, which was caused by increasingly autocratic neoliberalism in the last tens of years, which was caused and even the powerlessness and the isolation, which was even exacerbated by the corona measures and by now the wars are going on. We have to reunite. We have to think of how to bring forward democracy and humanism. And therefore, I think the Kurdish movement is a very good example. They do it of course, there is problems like everywhere, but they bring forward a democratic idea, an idea of equality, an idea of the rights of the minorities, and a real democratic society. And we have to think, we the people, how to support that. And the governments, they have to think where they want to go. Do they want to go as the Roman Empire because they are too static and they don't see their own crisis and the reality, which is where I just could describe small, small parts of, but at least some of the main parts. The reality is that there has to be changes, and these changes have to be done national and international. And if you look international in the Middle East, these changes can be done with the Kurdish movement, and those who are into power have to take that into account. And us, who are the people, we have to struggle for democracy and equality in our own country, so that in Middle East, those who struggle in Middle East are supported the best way. These are just some thoughts. There is so much we have to discuss, but that's not the time now. We have time later.
Thank you very much, Martin, and I hope maybe we're able to hear you just once more before we finish up. We have time now to just take a couple of questions from the floor. So yeah, I'm going to begin. I'm going to put two questions together as they're slightly similar. We have a question from Rojin Mukrian, who is a PhD researcher in Ireland working on the Kurdish issue, who asks, does a bottom-up diplomacy led by the people have the potential to balance out top-down state diplomacy? And we have a similar question from Sarah Glynn, an academic and a regular contributor to Media News, who asks, is there any possibility for the growth of a grassroots peace movement in Turkey itself beyond the Kurdish movement that could push the government from below? So maybe Adem or Fayek, you could speak about the possibility for a diplomacy of the people, a movement from below in Turkey that could push the government to act.
Yeah, thank you very much. I can say something on that. So when we speak about diplomacy and about peace talks and negotiations processes, we should not only speak about the involvement of the main powers who have caused this question and asking them to use their power to make pressure on Turkey and to or to convince or to stay natural. But a peace talk or negotiations process without the support of the public opinion or by the society, by the women, by the youth, by the civil organizations will not succeed. So therefore, it is very important that we should try to do our best to gain the support from the grassroots organizations, from the people, from the associations, and from the ecological movements, women movements, because that war is causing a lot of things to them too. They're affected from that war. They're suffering from that war. And of course, they deserve a more democratic and peaceful life too. And they by themselves, with their efforts for democracy, for peace, and for equality, they have contributed a lot to the struggle. They have contributed a lot for freedom. They have contributed a lot for democracy. And they are not only outsider from this process. They should be involved. They should have their voice. They should have the say. They should participate. So if you do not have the public opinion, if you do not have these kind of organizations of leading figures or the women's being part of the negotiations process or being part of the process at all, I think then you cannot find a reconciliation. You cannot find and lasting solution. And so therefore it is very important not just attaching or approaching or asking them to be part of, trying to be with them together, trying to do with them together, trying to involve them too, because the moral, the society, the politics is really in the public opinion itself. And when we speak about media has to play a big role too in the negotiations process, because through media and through all the reports coming out, you can legitimize the right for self-determination, you can legitimize the right for peace, you can legitimize the right for democracy. And on the other hand, you can criticize both sides if they are engaging in some mistakes or if they are not willing to accept the invitations for a peace process. So therefore, I think it is very important to do that. It's a big power to the media and experts. You have to invite experts too, because that problem, the Kurdish problem, when we speak now specifically about the Kurdish problem, is not only a political problem. It is a social problem, economical problem, geographical problem, linguistic problem. It is a societal problem. It is an area problem. It is international problem, because the international powers have caused are still helping that we cannot find any solution. The state-to-state relationship is still continuing. So therefore, we have to attach, we have to touch all the problems, not only some political rights, but social rights, women rights, ecological rights, economical rights, security rights, and so on and so on. And that is the society itself. And so therefore, I think we should work on that level too.
Thank you very much, Adam, for those thoughts. Maybe I think we just have time to squeeze in one more question before we wrap up, and We have a question from one of our listeners today, Alan. Thank you for this question, Alan. It's also something I'm interested to hear the answer to. Maybe, Martin, I can ask you this. Alan asks, is there anything to be learned from previous peace talks in the 20th and 21st century with the IRA, with the African National Congress, with the FARC in Colombia? Can we learn something from these successful peace processes? I see, actually, having just asked that to Martin, his signal has just cut out. So maybe Adam or Fayek, you could also speak about if we can learn something from previous 20th or 21st century peace processes with other groups as we think about a peace process between PKK and Turkey.
Yes, I can say something about this. The history of the peace talks between the PKK and Turkish state have shown us that without the participation of the people and getting, of course, be inspired by the other examples in the world, it's impossible to reach an agreement. Peace process cannot be successful. So it is very important to, of course, get the examples or get be inspired by the other peace talks. Unfortunately, Turkish state is reluctant to do the same or to take these examples in its attempts for a peaceful solution with the PKK. But we should learn, and we should, of course, get these examples in order to be successful in these processes. For example, when we look at the South Africa, when we look at the IRA and the Britain examples, or Spain and ETA or other conflicts in the world, we see that the states or the governments, without any hesitation, start dialogues with these organizations, and there are some other third parts or the observers and guarantees in the process. But unfortunately, when we look at the Turkish example, they say that we never talk with terrorists, and when they start the peace processes, they try to keep it alone, limited with the conflicting parties. And we know that if it is limited with the conflicting parties, it's impossible to find a solution. So it's very important to get some examples from the history and from the world.
Thank you so much, Fayek. And Martin, I see you're back with us now. Do you want to share just some closing thoughts on this question?
Yes, I can do. So if we look at the history of the IRA, of the ANC, of the FARC, there is some similarities and then there is some differences. For example, the IRA and the ANC, they made a lot of similar steps which are done by the Kurdish movement now, and they could succeed because the geostrategical whole frame was different than with the Kurdish movement, to my mind, until today. Because with the IRA, it just was the British colonialism, which had to be a bit overcome. And so it was possible that they were accepted as dialogue partner by the government. And the ANC, in that time, it was for the global economy, it was more efficient to have apartheid overcome. So there was a tunnel, there was a perspective that the struggle of the ANC could be successful. With the FARC made a successful peace process, but because of the circumstances in Colombia, after the peace process, many of the former FARC fighters were killed by paramilitary forces, by the Todesschwadron in German, the death squads, who killed them after the peace process. And now there's a leftist government, so maybe the peace process can go forward and there can be really solution. So I think the Kurdish government learned a lot already of IRA, ANC, and FARC, and they are in communication with each other, and there is single parts to learn. But then there is a different situation. We have the oil and gas in the Middle East. We have the Turkey as a police officer of the West in the in that region. Now we have Turkey, where Russia and NATO is struggling to be the best ally for Turkey. So there is a different geostrategical situation, which we have to take into account. There are similarities in the idea of equality, in the idea of respect of all ethnical and religious groups and so on, but there is differences as well. So I think we have to be very aware of what can be learned and where is similarities and where there is singularities in the different processes, because it doesn't matter if we want to bring forward socialism, anarchism, confederalism, or any humanist formation in societies. In the different areas of the world, there is some differences, but the main mechanisms are similar. So we can, I think, learn from the main mechanisms and the main ideas, but we have to bring in the analysis of the singularities of the different regions. Because to my mind, the peace process which Öcalan brought forward in the years before 2013, that was already according to the knowledge of which had been gained in the processes of the IRA and the ANC. But the Erdogan government and the fascist forces and actors in Turkey, like the MHP and other Islamist forces, they don't want that process to go on in any way, because they have total different idea of the develop of the region and of their worldwide role. We have to take that into account, but of course we have to learn from all the positive ideas in history. I think that's what Öcalan as well says, and I agree with that. We have to be in analysis to find out a positive synthesis of all humanist and progressive ideas, but in the moment there is a lot of negative synthesis which is coming against that. So we have to struggle long time, to my mind.
Thank you so much, Martin, for that. I mean, we could go on. We have a couple of questions that we didn't get to, but we've already run over. So I think, that's a good moment to bring this conversation to an end. But really, yeah, thank you a lot. Firstly, to all of you who've joined us here today, and those of you who put questions that we couldn't get to this time, please do come again. Keep engaging and keep asking. We appreciate it. Big thanks from Media News and also from the co-host for this event, Kurdish Peace Institute in Washington, who do very important work on this issue. And if you're not familiar with their work and their publications, their research papers, go and have a look at their website as well. And thank you also to all of our panelists. Thank you to Adem Uzun from the Keneke and Faike Yagazai from the People's Democratic Party, HDP, for sharing their kind of the first-hand knowledge of their institutions and their organizations of recent and historic peace processes and how these might be restarted or revitalized and the challenges facing that. Thank you to our other guests as well, to Megan Badette from the Kurdish Peace Institute, and also to Calvin Wilder from the New Lines Institute for sharing their proposals and perspectives as well on how to move things forward. And of course, as we just heard from Martin Dolzer, the experienced German politician who was able to share also some of his thoughts with us today. So thank you all for coming. I'm Matthew Broomfield. I've hosted this panel today for Media News. We really appreciate you all taking the time to join this conversation, and we hope to have you all here again very soon. Please do keep following Media News, subscribe to the various social medias, Twitters and so on. Thank you very much, and have a good evening. Good night.